Hi everyone, welcome back to another episode of Go Sports Crazy with your host, DJ Takeoff, only on Penguin Radio. Tonight's episode will feature heavily on the NBA and what is in the future since the finals ended a couple weeks ago. Today, we'll focus on the up-and-coming news within certain teams and players. I'm excited to get started, so let's get right into it. We'll begin with taking a look at Anthony Davis. Anthony Davis led Lakers to a championship by shooting like Kevin Durant, but can that really continue? Two other questions after the NBA bubble: is Kemba Walker done as a superstar, and did Jamal Murray take the leap? The NBA bubble has come and gone, and it was a rousing success. First, no positive COVID-19 tests, which feels like a small miracle. Second, the basketball was tremendous. In some cases, perhaps too tremendous. Multiple scouts who spoke with CBS Sports said they would be hesitant to put a lot of stock in anything we saw in the bubble. The circumstances were just too unique. With that in mind, here are three big questions coming out of the bubble. First, is Anthony Davis the new Kevin Durant? In the bubble, Anthony Davis shot the lights out, particularly from the malign mid-range, where Davis went from a 37% shooter in the regular season to 49% in the bubble, per Cleaning the Glass. Just factoring in long mid-range shots defined as 14 feet to the three-point line, Anthony Davis went from 33% in the regular season to 49% in the playoffs. In terms of frequency, Davis also took 25% more shots from the long mid-range than he did in the regular season, and 20% more from the overall mid-range in general, while taking almost 15% fewer shots at the rim. All of this is to say, Anthony Davis was a more frequent and a far more deadly jump shooter in the playoffs. So deadly, in fact, that those numbers were just rattled off, that we just rattled off are basically the exact mid-range equivalent of what Kevin Durant shot in his first two regular seasons with Golden State. That is mind-blowing. Durant, whose mid-range efficiency rose to truly laughable levels in his first two playoff stints with Golden State. 56% in 2016 through 2017 is probably the best mid-range shooter in the game today and one of the best ever. And so the question becomes, how much of his bubble shooting is sustainable for Davis? If he remains even close to this efficient from the mid-range, he truly becomes indefensible with his ability to face up and put the ball on the floor. We combine that with his post-game and three-point range, and that's just terrifying. The only real hope of defending Anthony Davis is allowing him to settle for mid-range shots and playing the averages, but if these are going to be his averages moving forward, that's just going to be a good night. The next question we face is Jamal Murray an all-star? If we take his bubble performance at face value, Jamal Murray has made the leap into superstardom, which is basically what it takes to make the all-star team as a guard in the Western Conference. Jamal Murray has never averaged more than 18.5 points per game in any of his four regular seasons, but he averaged 26.5 in this year's postseason. He has never averaged more than 4.8 assists in a regular season, but he averaged 6.6 in the postseason. He's never shot better than 37.8% from beyond the arc for a season, but he shot 45% in the postseason. We've known long enough that Jamal Murray was capable of being the best player on the floor on any given night, and he has a clear penchant for big stage performances. The consistency wasn't always there, but he did it every game in this year's playoffs. On the rare nights that he wasn't scoring big, he was a consistent playmaker, using the threat of his scoring and shooting to draw attention and create for others. Jamal Murray is in a unique situation in that he's the only point guard in the Western Conference with this kind of scoring ability that doesn't have control of his own offense. The Denver Nuggets run more action through Nikola Jokic, which explains some of Jamal Murray's inconsistencies as a scorer, because you just never know when it's going to be his game. Denver ran more through Murray in this year's playoffs because he was dominating, and if that continues, there is nothing fluky about him being a lights-out, if streaky, shooter, and his playmaking isn't a big surprise to me either. His ball skills are just elite, and always have been. But is he really this great? Because what Jamal Murray did in the bubble is another level. It's something not too far from a Steph Curry or a Damian Lillard level, frankly. Because Jokic will remain a prominent hub for Denver, and I don't expect Jamal Murray to be among the league's leading scorers. He'll have huge nights and statistically blah nights, but if his efficiency sustains anywhere near what we just saw from him in the postseason, the NBA better watch out. And the third question that we face is, Kemba Walker done as a superstar? I suppose whether Kemba Walker was ever a true superstar is a matter of opinion, but he averaged almost 26 points per game and was all NBA in 2018 through 2019, and he's made four straight All-Star games. The list of guys who've done that is short. Kemba Walker was very good in his first season with Boston, as he diminished traditional box score production with fewer points, few assists, and fewer shot attempts, was easily explainable by the increased talent around him and Boston's equitable offensive structure. But Kemba Walker dropped off in the playoffs. After a solid series versus Philadelphia in the first round, he shot under 35% from the field in three of the seven games versus Toronto, and he only cracked the 20-point barrier twice. Over games 6 and 7, he shot 1 for 13 from the three-point range. In game 6, he scored 5 points, and in game 7, he scored 14. Walker mixed in some very good games too, making for an up and down postseason, showing for what had become one of the more dependable scorers and creators in the league. But even when he had it going, he just never had that feeling that he was the best player on the floor, at least not for very long. And to be fair, he was the guy that teams often chose to double team. And he pretty clearly wasn't fully healthy. His knee nagged him throughout the latter part of the season, and that didn't go away in Orlando. He lacked normal explosion and a side-to-side shiftiness off the dribble. Perhaps that's a story here, Kemba Walker's health. Maybe once he gets back to 100% physically, he'll be back to his old self. But that doesn't feel like a sure thing. He's crested the 30-year-old mark now, and he's not going to be the same kind of focal point as the Celtics move forward with Jason Tatum as their clear to go player, heir egalitarian principles notwithstanding. Walker is owed $108 million over the next 3 years if he exercises his $37.6 million player option in 2023. He's been fantastic in the locker room, and his impact on the Celtics team goes way beyond the court. But him being a number one type option remains the bulk of his value. Is he still that player? Let's take a quick break before we are back with more news of the NBA on Go Sports Crazy with your host, DJ Takeoff, only on Penguin Radio. And we're back with more talk about the NBA and news about different players and teams on Go Sports Crazy with your host, DJ Takeoff, only on Penguin Radio. We're going to take a look at a player that plays for the San Antonio Spurs at the moment, but who knows what's going to happen next. And his name is DeMar DeRozan. Here are some DeMar DeRozan trade rumors. Five possible fits after anonymous agent claims that the star doesn't like playing for San Antonio. DeRozan's salary and skill set makes him very hard to trade. DeMar DeRozan was supposed to replace Kawhi Leonard as San Antonio's franchise player. That hasn't exactly happened. He hasn't made an all-star team since being traded to San Antonio, and the Spurs missed the playoffs for the first time since 1997 under his watch in the Orlando bubble. Now, DeMar DeRozan, who's 31, is mulling a $27.7 million player option and is reportedly unhappy in San Antonio. DeMar doesn't like San Antonio and doesn't want to be there, an anonymous agent told The Athletic. DeRozan seemingly refuted the report on Instagram with a post caption, "Me trying to figure out when I said that blank." But The Athletic was not the first source to suggest his displeasure with the Spurs. CNBC's Jabari Young, a former Spurs beat writer, said bluntly that DeMar is not happy in San Antonio on ESPN's San Antonio's The Blitz. The Spurs have a number of young guards that they need to devote minutes and touches to, including DeJounte Murray, Derek White, Keldon Johnson, and Lonnie Walker IV. Ideally, they'd probably like to move on from DeRozan and kickstart their rebuild around those youngsters. But DeRozan isn't going to decline that player option, or at least he shouldn't. Given his age and dip in production, there just isn't going to be a $27.7 million offer on the table for him this offseason. That is especially true given the impact coronavirus has had on the cap. If he is playing for a new team next season, it will almost certainly be through a trade. The question is, how many teams would want him? While DeMar DeRozan's shot creation could help a lesser team rise into playoff contention, his poor defense and lack of three-point shooting make him a poor fit on teams with championship aspirations. He doesn't fit particularly well alongside other stars, at least in theory, and at 31, younger teams probably wouldn't be very interested. That severely limits the sort of market San Antonio could drum up, but a few teams stand out as reasonable options. The agent that told The Atlantic about DeRozan's unhappiness in San Antonio suggested Detroit as a destination, given his connection to head coach Dwayne Casey. The Pistons have the cap space to absorb DeRozan relatively easily if they so choose. If they want to retain cap space, say, for a run at DeRozan's former teammate Fred VanVleet, they have some expiring salaries to potentially send back Tony Snell and Derrick Rose, so they can retain cap space. But still, the Pistons have been stuck in the middle of the Eastern Conference pack for years. A DeRozan-Blake Griffin core sounds like yet another number 8 seed, in a season that may not include gate revenue that may not appeal to Detroit. DeRozan is a Los Angeles native that grew up idolizing Kobe Bryant. The Lakers need another ball handler. A package built around the expiring salaries of Danny Green, JaVale McGee, and Avery Bradley is feasible. But all three of those players are better defenders than DeRozan. The Lakers won their championship with defense, and shooting was a concern as well. DeRozan doesn't help on that front either. The Lakers would have to be extremely confident in their shooting and defense, with every other rotation spot to take a shot on DeRozan. Never rule out the Knicks in a big name trade. Acquiring DeRozan would be cheaper in cash than a Chris Paul trade, and it would cost less in assets as well. If the goal is merely bringing in a star to help change the team's reputation, DeRozan could work. But Paul is almost certainly preferable on that front. His impact on Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is proof of what he can do for RJ Barrett and Mitchell Robinson. And his reputation as president of the NBPA is infallible. He can shoot. DeRozan can't. The Knicks need shooting around those two young cornerstones. This is a possibility, but a slim one. Orlando fits a similar mold as Toronto. Magic president Jeff Weltman came from Toronto, where he had a hand in building rosters around DeRozan. They've been without a primary perimeter scorer for years, and through Evan Fournier and Kem Birch, can scrounge together $20 million in expiring salaries. Like Detroit, though, the Magic probably aren't satisfied playing for the middle, especially with Jonathan Isaac out recovering from a torn ACL. They seem likelier to tank. Nothing that has happened since the trade suggests DeRozan would be interested in returning to Toronto. Masai Ujiri has admitted that their relationship hasn't been fully mended yet. But the Raptors lost to the Celtics because they had nobody that could create his own shot late in playoff games. DeRozan can, and his expiring salary wouldn't hamper their 2021 cap space ambitions. The issue here is making the money work. The Raptors don't have enough money to send back to the Spurs at this point to facilitate a deal, but there are possibilities through sign and trades or stepladder deals. The Spurs would get Norman Powell, a valuable role player whom the Raptors may like to move anyway given his 2021 through 2022 salary, and Patrick McCaw as salary ballast. The odds of this happening should be reviewed as nearly non-existent, but it makes sense in basketball terms. None of these trades are slam dunks. DeRozan's contract is hardly toxic, and his flaws aren't debilitating. But he's an expensive player that just doesn't fit onto many good teams as anything more than a low-end starter or sixth man. He isn't getting paid sixth man money, and in a cap crunch, few teams are going to want to overpay for someone that doesn't defend or shoot at a high level. DeRozan on a contender makes sense in a league that no longer exists. Let's take another quick break before we are back with news in the NBA on Go Sports Crazy with your host, DJ Takeoff, only on Penguin Radio. And we're back with another segment on the NBA and what's going on with players and teams on Go Sports Crazy with your host, DJ Takeoff, only on Penguin Radio. The next news we have in is the Lakers offseason preview. Chris Paul is an ideal trade target, but Rob Pelinka has other big name options. Whether it's Paul or others, the Lakers will be able to add significant talent during this offseason. The Lakers are inevitable. It takes years of planning for a normal team to win a title. The process is meticulous and frustrating, and random and cruel, and usually unforgiving. A missed draft pick here, a waste mid-level exception there, these are the sort of mistakes that derail ordinary contenders. And the Lakers don't play by the same rules. Their backup plan just won a championship. It's the reality that every team chasing them needs to dread. The team the Lakers just built wasn't even the one that they wanted. Plan A was Kawhi Leonard. He chose the Clippers, and look how that turned out. So they turned to Plan B. The few remaining free agent role players left on the market 6 days after the frenzy began. Plan B was enough to win them a championship in 2020. Plan B won't be necessary for 2021, though. The Lakers have no illusions of free agent glory during this offseason. What they do have is the bulk of a championship roster returning, the assets to significantly improve upon it, and the time to build an actionable plan to do just that. The rest of the NBA isn't getting a week-long head start on the Lakers in free agency this time around. They aren't dealing with a Laker team that has spent all of its trade assets either. They're dealing with a Laker team operating under the same schedule and with many of the same opportunities as everybody else. That's hardly the level playing field it appears to be, because the Lakers get to start with LeBron James and Anthony Davis. Those two just won a championship with little more than the scraps of 2019 free agency at their side. A full offseason is only going to lengthen their lead over the rest of the NBA. So how wide will that gap be? Here is the 2020 Lakers offseason preview, detailing every tool the champions will have at their disposal as they attempt to defend their crown. Spoiler alert, there are a lot of them. One note before beginning, I'll be using SpotTrack for the player salaries and 2019 through 20 cap numbers for this exercise as a whole. That includes previously agreed upon numbers like the rookie scale and the minimum salary. A frozen cap is the likeliest outcome of negotiations between the league and the NBPA, but these numbers could theoretically change in either direction. Under the assumption that the 2019 through 20 numbers will be used, these are the pertinent numbers for these projections. The Lakers have a salary cap of $109,140,000, and their non-taxpayer mid-level exception is $9,258,000. The luxury tax they have is $132,627,000, and the taxpayer mid-level exception for year one would be $5,718,000. The luxury tax apron is $138,928,000. The cap room mid-level exception for year one would be $4,767,000. The salary floor would be $98,226,000, and the biannual exception is $3,623,000. Here's the cap situation and overall finances. The Lakers made a conscious decision in 2019 to prioritize 2021 over 2020. Most of their free agents got one-year deals with player options for the sake of preserving space for 2021's bonanza. Ironically, they are now somewhat unlikely to participate meaningfully in 2021 free agency. The pandemic lowered cap projections enough to make it virtually impossible for them to create the space for Giannis Antetokounmpo. So in all likelihood, the Lakers will spend this offseason building for the James Davis window. Their conservative 2019 offseason will still work to their advantage, though. The Lakers will enter the 2020 offseason below the cap. A new deal for Davis quickly wipes away any practical space, but they still have so little committed that they'll be able to operate relatively freely from a financial perspective. LeBron James is getting $39,219,565 a year, and Anthony Davis, his estimate, is $32,742,000, with Danny Green getting almost half of that, and Kyle Kuzma getting one-fifth of what Danny Green's getting, and Alex Caruso getting close to Kyle Kuzma, and so on and so forth. First things first, Davis will reportedly re-sign with the Lakers after opting out, but the uncertain cap gives him an uncertain cap number. He is getting the max, but as the max is based on a percentage of the salary cap, we can't set an exact dollar figure. Davis has 8 years of NBA experience, meaning he's eligible for up to 30% of the cap in the first season of a new deal. Using last year's cap number, that takes us to $32.7 million. And then that number takes us to $102,122,388, around $7 million below the cap. But more importantly, it is nearly $37 million below the apron. And that gives the Lakers two possible financial pathways during the offseason. If they choose to use only the smaller taxpayer mid-level exception, they are free to spend as much cash as they'd like within the confines of the cap. This is the path of least resistance, the road that they'll take if the plan is simply to bring everybody back and add one meaningful free agent and then focus on the trade market. But the other, possibly more tempting option would be to use both the non-taxpayer mid-level exception and the biannual exception. That would allow them to sign two free agents above the minimum, one for $9.3 million and the other for $3.6 million. But it would force them to remain below the apron for the entire season. Given the cost of those two additions, the Lakers would have just under $24 million to spend on the final six players on their roster. Most of those players are likely incumbents, as they still have several options of their own to sort through. To name a few, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, a player option, would have $8,493,746, Avery Bradley making just about over half of that, and Rajon Rondo, who is making $2,619,605. Bradley and McGee are probably opting in, whether the Lakers want them to or not. Bradley's bubble absence and McGee's bubble irrelevance makes it highly unlikely that either would get a raise on the market. Their returns take us down to $15 million to work with. Quinn Cook is not guaranteed, but keeping him around as a trade fodder makes more sense than eating $1 million in a dead salary. Caldwell Pope and Rajon Rondo are reportedly opting out, and both have earned raises. This is where things get a little tricky. Caldwell Pope might be the best 3-and-D player on the market. The Lakers have a number of advantages in re-signing him, but it might take more than $12 million in the first season to retain him. Given the money they have left to offer in this scenario, they could give him just over $52.5 million over 4 years. That does not account for Rondo, and it leaves the Lakers with just 13 players. There are further workarounds here. Having the full mid-level exception doesn't necessarily mean using all of it. The Lakers could stash their first round pick in Europe. McGee and Cook are easy enough to dump in trades, and there are solutions here, and they're worth exploring considering just how much optionality the Lakers could have with these exceptions. In so much as the Lakers actually have needs, four stand out as archetypes to pursue. The Lakers solely lack ball handling aside from James during the regular season, and while Rondo filled that void in the playoffs, he's a 34-year-old free agent and probably shouldn't be relied upon. They could use another small forward-sized defender as well, especially for a possible Clippers matchup, to make sure that LeBron can save some energy for offense. And then there's shooting. The Lakers rank 23rd in three-point attempts and 21st in three-point percentage. They worked around this defect in the playoffs, but better spacing would undeniably make life easier for James and Davis. That would especially be true if they could find a shooting center that wouldn't hurt them defensively, as it would allow the Lakers to play the entire playoff games without a true center cramping the floor if they so choose. Let's take one last quick break before we are back with more of the NBA and news on players and teams on Go Sports Crazy with your host, DJ Takeoff. Only on Penguin Radio. And we're back with one last segment on Go Sports Crazy with your host, DJ Takeoff, only on Penguin Radio. Tonight we've been focusing a lot on the NBA news and what the off-season previews are looking like. Here's the Clippers off-season preview with Goran Dragic, Marc Gasol, who are highlight realistic free agent targets. The Clippers have decisions to make this offseason, but they have a few pathways to improvement. One of the biggest mistakes NBA teams routinely make is building for the past instead of the present. The Houston Rockets are notorious offenders. Their microball lineup would have worked wonders against the Golden State Warriors. But the Warriors were no longer their competition for the championship. As we later found out, the Lakers were. And Houston's gambit failed because of how ill-equipped it was for Anthony Davis's size. Quietly, the Clippers fell for the same fallacy. They looked at the league that the Warriors left in their wake and decided that traditional positional roles were meaningless. They assumed that Kawhi Leonard, a small forward, could function as a primary ball handler, and that center defense was a luxury as long as they were strong enough at the point of attack. It wasn't just that their two best players were wings. Functionally, even their non-wings were, essentially, wings. Patrick Beverley and Jamichael Green, functioned as switchable shooters, not traditional archetypes for their positions. At the trade deadline, they cashed in their only chip, their own 2020 first-round pick, for another wing in Marcus Morris rather than a point guard or a center. You can blame Montrezl Harrell's playing time for the Clippers' loss, or poor chemistry, or any number of other valid flaws, but the broad explanation here is that the Clippers were rigid and predictable. Most of their players did basically the same things, and when the Nuggets figured out how to stop those things, they didn't have a roster capable of countering. They might not have needed to be in a season featuring only the Warriors as co-contenders, but as the Rockets found, 2020's playoff field was so varied that surviving it required adaptability that they just didn't have. The Lakers did, though, and that's why they're the champions. That's why they're the champions right now. It's what the Clippers need to match this offseason, and it will be an enormously difficult balancing act. The Clippers need to diversify their roster without sacrificing what made it special in the first place. And they need to do so through a fairly limited set of team-building tools. The Clippers don't have a single tradable first-round pick. Major free agent activity would require sacrifices, but their talent alone guarantees that a pathway to the championship exists for the Clippers. This off-season preview will try to find it. One note before beginning, I'm still using SpotTrack for player salaries in 2019 through 20 cap numbers for this exercise as a whole. That includes previously agreed upon numbers like the rookie scale and the minimum salary. A frozen cap is the likeliest outcome of negotiations between the league and the NBPA, but these numbers could theoretically change in either direction. Under the assumption that the 2019 through 20 numbers will be used, these are the pertinent numbers for these projections. The Clippers have a salary cap of $109,140,000, a luxury tax of $132,627,000, a luxury tax apron of $138,928,000, and a salary floor of $98,226,000. Here's the cap situation and overall finances. The Lakers and Clippers took very different paths to max cap space in 2019. The Lakers cleared the decks almost entirely, and as a result, were able to build flexibility into their roster on a year-to-year basis. The Clippers went the other way. They built a cohesive team with the idea that a star or two could be dropped easily into it. That, in large part, is why the Clippers were favored over the Lakers for most of the season. The Lakers were supposed to need time to build a championship-caliber roster. The Clippers, in theory, already had one. That's obviously not how things played out, and that makes things significantly harder for the Los Angeles Clippers. They were built to win right away, with each progressive championship getting harder and harder to earn given everything they gave up to build their supposed juggernaut. The Clippers have little to trade, and some of the role players they either had in place before Kawhi Leonard and Paul George joined or acquired after the fact are now due new contracts. As it stands right now, the Clippers are well above the cap and near locked to pay the tax. Cap space is out of the question here. The number worth watching is the cap apron. If the Clippers want to add a starting caliber player in free agency, they will probably have to use a non-taxpayer mid-level exception. That adds around $9,258,000 to their ledger and hard caps them at least the apron number of $108,928,000. With their current committed salaries, they would have only $13,888,323 left to spend on the entire rest of the roster. That might not be enough to keep either Marcus Morris or Montrezl Harrell, and certainly isn't enough for both. Normal teams might attach draft picks to dump some salary, but the Clippers only have second-round picks to offer in an environment with very little cap space to move a player like Rodney Magruder into. In all likelihood, that means the full mid-level exception is going to cost the Clippers either Marcus or Harrell. For a variety of reasons, Morris is the preferable keeper. His skill set is significantly harder to find on the market, whereas a reasonable thought of Harrell's rolling can usually be found for the minimum. He gives them lineup optionality as a small ball 3-and-D center against opponents not built to combat that. He is also, frankly, the better player and an easier sell to the locker room that Harrell did not just seem thrilled to be a part of last season. Now, there is a scenario in which the Clippers could keep both players. If they choose to use a smaller taxpayer mid-level exception, they won't be hard-capped and can throw around Steve Ballmer's cash however they see fit. There is a real argument in favor of this path. Three good players are better than two. Keeping Morris and Harrell allows the Clippers to potentially trade them later. And in such a bad financial market, some of their targets might be just as willing to accept $5.7 million as they would $9.3 million, depending on what else is out there. And that is the ultimate question at play here. What can the Clippers get for the non-taxpayer mid-level exception? And is it worth sacrificing Morris or Harrell? The answer is maybe. The Clippers have two primary needs to consider with that slot. The first is a point guard, as the Clippers finished 28th in total passes last season and 22nd in assists. Kawhi Leonard has grown significantly as a passer, but he can't run an offense by himself. The second need, as demonstrated by Nikola Jokic, is a better low post defender at center, ideally one that doesn't hurt the offense. But ultimately, in a perfect world, the Clippers would keep Morris and Harrell and just hope that one of their targets is willing to leave some money on the table. That's hardly an impossibility. There are so many centers that one of them is probably going to end up losing the game of financial musical chairs. Maybe the Heat decide to pivot off their own free agents and spend their cap space elsewhere, and a market doesn't develop for Dragic. If the Clippers can avoid committing as long as possible, they probably should. And that's all we have time for on tonight's episode of Go Sports Crazy with your host, DJ Takeoff, only on Penguin Radio. Tune in for more news of the NBA and much more on sports next week. Thanks for listening.